Good afternoon now, I guess. May it please the court, I'm George Sato on behalf of defendant Michael Franklin. Defendant Michael Franklin was tried and convicted by a jury whose composition may have been improperly shaped through the use of racially discriminatory peremptory strikes. The Batson test is a procedure designed to provide courts and the public with a measure of assurance that convictions are not the product of race-based...
There were more blacks on the jury than there were in the jury veneer, so what's the complaint? I don't understand.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
There were more blacks on the jury, a higher percentage on the jury than in the veneer, so why wouldn't that rebut a Batson claim?
Well, that only reflects the fact that there was underrepresentation of African Americans in the veneer to begin with. That only is really an indictment of the fact that this veneer only had 4 out of its total of 36 members that were African Americans. So we're really just talking about small numbers, and you're just comparing small numbers here. But if you're just comparing those ratios, that's the wrong metric. It just says that
he ended up on the jury. Right, there were 2 on the jury, right?
That's correct, and 2 were stricken. At the time of the objection...
Well, how many do you want on the jury?
It's not that... Well, I mean...
You want to have a third of the jury black or something, or what?
Well, that's not the point. I mean, the point is at the time of the objection.
That's the point, actually. I don't understand.
I mean, well, there isn't a single number that's correct. The point is that the jury composition itself could have been tainted or by the use of discriminatory strikes against those 2 jurors that were stricken in the first panel. At the time, only 1 other black juror had been accepted. So 2 out of the first two strikes were used against 11%, what was 11% of the jury pool at that time.
What showing had been made that the 2 strikes that you complained about were racially motivated?
Well, first, at the time of the objection, the defendants made 3 observations. The first was that the defendant was also African-American, so there was a commonality of race. The second was...
So was the victim of the crime.
Well, the victim was probably more likely the store, or one of the victims was Arab-American.
Virtually all of the witnesses were African-American, except for one.
Well, the one was the chief eyewitness, Fersen Sharkey, who said, "I saw the guy in the face." That's Michael Franklin. So the chief eyewitness was Arab-American, so race could have played a role, in theory, in terms of the weighing the credibility of the...
The jury is pro-Arab, you think, or what?
I'm sorry?
The jury is pro-Arab?
I'm just saying that was an opportunity for racial prejudices.
It's so unrealistic. Ridiculous. What do you think? You think Arabs are really popular witnesses in the United States?
I mean, I'm not going to speculate on that.
If you want to have a new trial, you want to have some plausibility to your complaints.
Well, there were additional factors as well. I mean, the other factor was that there were 2 strikes in a row. That was stated by the defendant.
I don't understand. What possible significance could 2 strikes in a row have?
Well, that, because of the initial underrepresentation veneer, the fact that this was a very tiny African-American jury population to begin with, the fact that this happened at the very beginning of the peremptory process in the first panel, 2 strikes in a row could constitute a pattern.
So that's a prima facie case anytime there are 2 strikes against minorities in a row?
No. That is merely a relevant circumstance. It could be a relevant circumstance.
Relevant. It just depends how they line up, right? Whether you have 2 in a row or divided. Why would that be?
Well, it depends on the manner in which strikes are used. So the manner in which they were used is, in this case, it was the first panel. It was readily apparent to everybody that there was a tiny African-American population. And the fact that it was 2 in a row, 2 in a row, if you're flipping a coin, might not mean anything. But if you're talking about going to Vegas and you hit 2 jackpots in a row, that's a big difference. It depends on the context.
No, it doesn't make any difference. I don't know what you're talking about. There's such a thing as randomness, right? Randomness means you have runs, right? There's no surprise. If you flip 2 heads in a row, there's absolutely no surprise in that. If you win 2 jackpots, it's exactly the same. It's just random.
I mean, I would argue that, I mean, yes, it's random, but obviously, I think that in a common sense way, if you hit 2 jackpots in Vegas...
Oh, that's ridiculous. Look, unless it's fixed in some way, There's nothing more anomalous about flipping two heads in a row than there is about flipping a head and a tail and a head.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly, because
there's
it's
no anomaly to that. There's no anomaly.
Exactly. You're right. Exactly.
There's
because
no anomaly. If you go to a casino and you happen to and you win two jackpots an hour apart versus two a minute apart, that's just the operation of randomness.
I'm saying that's true in the casino sense because we understand that there are probabilities. The house has the odds. Flipping a coin, we understand it's a 50% odds basis. In the context of peremptory strikes being used in selection of a jury, however, the presumption is that these are often vehicles for the use of introduction of race-based strategies in the jury selection process.
Introduction of racism and the use of peremptory challenges.
It's in the Batson case. It is a presumption that
presumption of racism. There's an opportunity for the lawyer to raise a question. That's all there is.
Correct. I stand corrected. You're right. I didn't mean to say it in that way. But what I am trying to say is that the fact is, in the human context, two can be a pattern. If your child commits the same error twice,
two can't be a pattern. Come on.
Well, I don't know if we can say that as a matter of law. You know, in the common sense practice, if I commit the same error twice at home, I'm going to hear it. Okay, but there were other factors as well.
And what were they?
These two jurors were heterogeneous. They had no other common factors other than the fact of their race. One was a middle-aged to elderly black woman who was a housekeeper from a blue-collar background. The other was a young black male who was a white-collar professional. If you were a political pundit, you would say one was the Hillary Clinton voter, one was the Barack Obama voter. These are two demographics that, but for the fact of their race, made them completely different.
That wasn't the end of the inquiry, though. There were questions about who she lived with and her housemate, boyfriend, if you would, had done time. And with respect to the male juror, he had a prior, what he described as a traffic incident, which actually turned out to be a driving under the influence charge.
Certainly. And
so there were other factors.
Yes, but well, what's
completely, completely.
That's. First of all, both jurors stated that they could be fair and impartial in a questioning, so they're both qualified to serve on the jury. The second point is that the prosecution never raised a challenge for cause against Ms. Cooley. So if the prosecutor was...
There's no basis for cause. No.
Well,
why would be a basis for cause?
The appellate court's inference is that these two jurors were unsuitable to serve on a jury. That's a for-cause challenge. At least it could have been articulated
and
as a for-cause challenge.
Now you're just erasing the distinction between a peremptory challenge and a challenge for cause. The fact that a juror may seem, you know, likely to lean in one direction doesn't mean there's cause to strike the juror. If there's, you know, real evidence of bias, sure. But obviously peremptory challenges are exercised because you think the juror is not favorable to you, but that's not a basis for striking for cause.
The Batson test is designed to get actual reasons for strikes, not speculation after the fact.
If a prima facie case is shown, what was the prima facie case here?
Well,
these were discriminatory challenges.
Yeah, there were circumstances that existed that permitted the inference of discrimination. For instance, the fact that these were two high-impact strikes that were used right away, that they were also against two heterogeneous jurors who had nothing...
Ultimately, not very high impact when the full jury was seated.
Well, at the time of the objection, they were, and that is the relevant frame for reference. But even at the end of the day, they still were. If you perform the correct disparate impact inquiry, even the fact that there were two on the jury doesn't reflect the fact that there could have been more, and in addition to the fact, it doesn't reflect the fact that those other strikes were comparatively small, but that the strikes were used in a disproportionate ratio against African-American jurors. And that's the question. Even the strike of a single juror can reflect invidious intent sufficient to constitute a Batson violation.
True. If the prima facie case is shown. Which is not just the strike. There's got to be something else.
Correct. And then this is a low hurdle, a very low hurdle under Johnson v. California, which was never once mentioned in the appellate court decision. I would like to reserve a minute of time for...
Thank you. So, Mr. Truitt?
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'm Eric Truitt, Assistant Attorney General, representing the respondent. I'd like to first address a point that was made here at oral argument and in the reply brief a couple of times, and that is the order of the strikes used by the state. If you look at the full voir dire, the two African-American jurors were not struck in a row. Ms. Cooley was struck. Ms. Menefe, I believe his pronunciation is African-American, she was seated, and then Mr. Tyson was struck. So assuming their theory that you can take a great deal of significance from the fact that two in a row were struck, then you would have to infer the other way, that if they exercised one strike, seated an African-American juror, and then exercised another strike, that that would counsel against an inference of discrimination. It also addresses the theory that they raised that the state was somehow deterred from exercising additional strikes because of the Batson motion. The fact that they seated an African-American before the Batson motion was ever made seemed to indicate that the prosecution was just making its decisions based on its assumptions about what would make good jurors for this particular case. One thing that's noticeably absent from their briefs and the discussion here is the role that 2254D plays in these deliberations. I would agree this would be a much closer case if this was, you know, coming from a district court, you know, in a federal criminal conviction, but this is a state conviction. The state court adjudicated the claim on the merits, and that this court is barred from granting relief unless that decision was contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law or was based on an unreasonable determination of facts. And while they've had different theories at different times in their briefs, they've never really clearly demonstrated what was unreasonable about the state appellate court's decision. State appellate court identified Batson as the governing law. It then took Williams and its predecessors, which are the Illinois cases implementing step one of Batson, identified that correctly. Petitioner utilized the same seven Williams factors in his own...
Excuse me, but didn't the trial judge use some of the Swain language when he was talking about the Batson challenge, systematic exclusion language?
Yes, the trial court did use that phrase. As an initial matter, respondent believes that that's not the relevant inquiry because it's the state appellate decisions that counts, the state appellate court's decision that counts, not the trial court's. As a secondary matter, the state appellate court found as a matter of fact that the trial court applied Batson and not Swain by analyzing the record, and that would be afforded deference under 2254 D2 and E1. And as a third matter, if you look, there was a similar case before this court, McCain, which involved some of the similar language, and the factors that McCain instructed to look at to see whether or not the trial court understood that Batson was the proper standard, those are the same kinds of things that this trial court did. For example, this trial court made no inquiries about whether or not there was pattern and practice in other cases. It was only concerned about this particular case. You would think if he was applying Swain, then he would be looking at a pattern of practice in Cook County generally. There's also the correcting of defense counsel at various points about the ordering of making a prima facie case and then having the state provide its reasons. There's also further evidence of its understanding of Batson. Did you have a question? During the reverse Batson proceeding, where he, you know, showed his understanding that you could make a Batson claim even if there were, you know, both on a reverse race basis and also if people of that race were seated on the jury. So I think if you look at the record of the whole, In line with McCain, the trial court understood Batson, and you know the record, especially in a state trial court setting, doesn't always reflect everything. You know, the full knowledge sometimes tends to be short, and so, but you can, you know, there are enough indications there that the trial court understood that, that Batson was the proper standard.
I need a clarification on this method of jury selection that was used by the state trial judge in this case. Maybe this is how it's done in Cook County among all the judges. I'm just not familiar with it. The record appears to describe a process of voir dire where jurors are examined and strikes are issued against prospective jurors in six juror panels, where six jurors are brought to the courtroom and are questioned by the court and counsel, and strikes are used or not used, as the case may be, and then another panel is brought in.
My understanding is that, excuse me.
It seems to me it invites these sorts of problems.
From reading the voir dire transcript, I don't have any experience with the process beyond, you know, what I've learned from this case. But from reading the transcript, it appears that the judge conducted the initial examinations, and then they did the strikes for cause. I believe it was 18, and then 18, and then they had panels of four. And then once they would exercise peremptories, and then once they got four, they would seat those four and then move on to another four. That's it. At least from looking at the transcript, that they were doing it in blocks of four.
How many peremptory challenges did each side have?
Seven. So the state, and that's one of the factors that the state appellate court noted that counseled against an inference of discrimination, is that the state had seven peremptory challenges, but only exercised two of them on African Americans. And is
did it use the rest?
Yes, it used all, both sides used all seven. Mm-hmm. Just as a comparative note, the you know, the prosecution made a reverse Batson motion where the defendant had exercised six of his seven strikes against Caucasians, and then one against a light-skinned Latino, and the trial court denied that motion as well. So if you were to draw an inference based on statistics under their theory, you would think that the prosecution would have a, you know, a slam dunk prima facie case against the defendant.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Truitt. So Mr. Sato, we'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like just to address the appellate court's reasoning and why it was manifestly unreasonable. There are three reasons. The first is that they only looked at a transcript. They did not look at the totality of the evidence. And you can't make a suitability determination from a transcript alone. In fact, that was basic, that's an inference you can draw from the Snyder case that was recently decided by the Supreme Court, that there must have been a trial court finding. The second is that they failed to consider the disparate impact inquiry that Cockrell suggested that courts use, that they applied, the Supreme Court applied in Cockrell. They thus did not consider the fact. They looked at absolute numbers, which were misleading in this case. For example, there were fewer African-American juror venire members than there were total peremptory strikes. So if you're going to compare the number of strikes versus the number of jurors stricken versus the number of total strikes or the percentage of strikes used, you're always going to come up with a low number because you're starting out at a low baseline. And the third point is that it simply did not consider Johnson. It did not consider the low, low burden at the prima facie case stage. Was this, could this be seen as facially suspicious? That's
do
all it was.
Do you agree with Mr. Truitt that he made a, that the state made a prima facie case also?
Even if they had, that's, as this court noted in Stevens, it's irrelevant. The fact that there might have been discrimination going one way does not excuse the state using race-based strategies in its jury selection process. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not, Mr. Sato?
That's correct.
We thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client, and of course we thank Mr. Truitt as well, and the court will be in recess.